Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
And now, please welcome Neil Jordan.
Hello, thank you very much.
Okay, and congratulations. Beautiful film. I guess the New York word for somebody who would dare to remake Bob Lifflin Boer would be chutzpah. So what's what tell us about your relationship with the film, with the original film, and what that movie, what the Melville film meant to you, and why you wanted to take a crack at it.
Well, I love the film, you know, but I didn't think that it would be something I'd ever want to remake. My producer Stephen Woolley suggested it, and somebody in Warner Brothers was thinking along the same lines. So that's how it happened. It was presented to me, and you know, I looked at the original movie and. You know, I was very nervous about it, but I said, I'll try and write a script. And I began to write the script and the story. I began to double up on the story, you know, and use the basic story in the plot of the Melville film as a decoy for the plot that my Nick Nolte Bob was coming up with, you know. And then it became interesting. It became like a variation of the original film. And I thought, maybe if I make this, I'll do something that won't, you know, stamp all over the original and that will be kind of a variation on it.
What was it about the original film that was inspiring for you? It was a film that inspired a lot of filmmakers. It had a freedom to it, a romanticism. I mean, what did you find in it?
Well, I mean, it's actually quite a classical film, I think. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, people say, they talk about the French New Wave and all that, but the cameras in the Melville movie is terribly static, you know? And it's got this beautiful, you know, kind of patina of light and shade. Well, I think what was good in, was the fact that it was somebody... I think it was when it was re-released in New York, I read somewhere, some critic said, it's the only film noir that ends happily, you know? And I thought that basic movement, you know, from darkness to the light was really great about it.
You know, one of the wonderful things about both films, both the Melville and yours, is the nighttime photography. Melville said at the time that he made his film at night because you write love letters at night, and he felt his film was sort of a love letter to Paris, but... Could you talk about the shooting at night and the what that
Because Nick plays a junkie, I made him obviously, as you've seen, a guy who sticks needles in his fingers, and he's so I wanted the photography to feel like a withdrawal or like a hangover, you know, and I wanted to obviously, most of these stories kind of happen at night anyway, you know, but I wanted all the lights to be too flary and, you know, the camera movements to be jagged and we used that double printing thing, step printing, you know, where the kind of movement shutters. So
right.
it's not like Melville's film photographically at all, really.
Right.
But we were lucky enough to get the old town at Nice and to be able to use it as a set, basically. I mean, we built all those lights into the entire complex of streets, you know, so we used it almost like a big set, you know.
You made a few key changes from the Melville film. The setting of the film is different. This is not set in Paris as the Melville film was. Could you talk about how you changed the setting and then also the main character, the idea of an American being the main character?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing to do, I suppose, would be to set in America. It would be, that's probably what the studio would have wanted, you know.
But, Las Vegas.
Vegas, or like New York and Atlantic City or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
But I looked at Paris and I looked at the casino in Deauville, which was tiny. You know, it's hardly there. It's only about three tables in it. And Deauville actually is a very British city. You know, it's in Normandy, and it looks like a town in the south of England. So it hadn't got much romance to it. So everybody knows Nice from the Cannes Festival, but nobody ever spends any time there. So I spent a bit of time wandering around, and I thought that we could create a real, you know, an environment full of richness and darkness and kind of danger out of there.
The world of the casino, there's a real romanticism and a beauty to the way you show the casino, which is much more developed than in the. Than in the Melville film, I mean, and that seems to be something you've really brought to it. Could you just talk about?
Yeah, but the Melville casino sequences—they're very elegant, actually. They play chemin de fer, you know, or chemin à fer, is it called? That's four card. That's odd little game, which with the big paddles and they turn. So there's a great elegance and ritual to those gambling sequences in the Melville movie. But I mean, casinos are generally, I'm so sure everybody's been to Las Vegas. You know, they're full of neon lights and they're full of slot machines. And even the casino in Monte Carlo, it's designed by Garnier, the guy who did the Opera House in Paris. But all of the detail is way up towards the ceiling, you know. So all you see really is a shabby carpet and a load of tables and a load of overdressed, you know, Russian and French people playing, you know. So we kind of made up the casino really out of a load of interiors in and around Nice. There's very rich Art Deco, you know, turn of the century and later 20s interiors. So we used a whole sequence of those to create this kind of mystery and warmth, really.
Could you talk about the casting in this film is incredibly varied and very rich and gives so much texture to the film. I mean, the two I want to ask you about are Nick Nolte, because that's so critical, and then the young actress, Nuza Kakinadze, who was 17, really a newcomer at the time, who plays Anna.
Yeah, well, Nick is, Nick was kind of, he emerged as the only casting for the role. As you imagine, it's very tricky doing something like this, you know, because it's the lines are, the dialogue is very important, and I put myself out there with the way people spoke, you know. I decided to have them just talk constantly in this hard-boiled way, you know. And if it was a $20 million star, they're all too well preserved these days to convince you, you know. And
yeah.
I went to see Nick in San Francisco. He was in a play with Sam Shepard called The Late Henry Moss, and the entire play seemed to consist of Nick being kicked around the stage by Sean Penn, you know. Literally, and he was subjected to savage kind of indignity. And I met him afterwards, and I thought this guy is perfect for this role because you can see it on his face. And so that was my decision to make the movie when he said he'd do it. Basically.
And you didn't have him in mind, or when you were writing it, you didn't have a particular actor in mind.
No, I didn't have anybody in mind actually.
Yeah. And I did want to ask you about writing, because you were a writer, you know, and really an established short story writer and novelist before you went into film. And I was curious how you made that transition. Because your first film, I mean, you did Angel and Company of Wolves, you know, terrific first and second film. But how did you make that move?
Well, I just was lucky. I was in Ireland. I was writing fiction and I was writing some screenplays that were being made as tiny budget independent movies. Mm-hmm. And anytime I saw something that I'd written to get made, I was always very unhappy with the results. And I wrote a script that John Borman agreed to produce for me, and Channel 4, Film 4 had just set up then to make, writer-director type films. And I was lucky enough for them to back my first feature film, Angel. So that's how it happened to me, really.
Okay. I cut you off I did want to hear about the actress.
Nuza.
Nuza, because I guess another interesting parallel to the Melville film is that the young actress in that film, who was, I think, 15 years old, was discovered literally on the streets by Melville. She was driving around.
Yes.
And could you talk about how you discovered
Nuza? Well, I mean, Nuza, I didn't discover Nuza. She'd done one film called 28 Stolen Kisses or something. I forget the title. It's a tiny little Georgian movie.
Yeah.
And she was she was very good in that. But when I met her, I hadn't seen that. You know, she came to London and I just did a quick camera test with her, and I just thought she was extraordinary. You know, that she had a poise, and she had this great deep voice, but yet all this youth. Just, you know, she's so kind of like a deer or something, you know. And when I began to shoot some stuff with her, I could just see this extraordinary thing going on in her face, you know. So I think she's great, you know. It's her first real performance, this, I think, but I hope she does a lot of good things, you know.
And the rest of the cast is very international, very diverse.
I think of it as a Mediterranean film, really, because, you know, everybody from North Africa is trying to get into those Mediterranean cities, and everybody from what the former Soviet Union is trying to get in there, and from Turkey, and, you know, everywhere. So it's a kind of racial melting pot there in a very different way than America is. I don't know how to describe it, really, but it's maybe it's a bit more abrasive there in some ways, you know. So, I mean, I'd written the Russian, the guy from Vladivostok. I'd written in the two, you know, Said and Paolo as two North African guys. And obviously Nutza was Russian, you know, or so she was Russian, but she's Georgian, actually.
Right.
But so I went to Paris and I just met everybody I could, you know, and I'm sure you all know Saeed Teghmoui, yeah, from Three Kings and from La Haine. And there's a wonderful young actor that I found called Wassini Embarak. He plays Saeed, the guy who shot. Now, he is extraordinary. Mm. You know, he's got this street quality. He's got a very tiny part in the movie, but he is an extraordinary actor. And Amir Costa Rica. I mean, Amir is a great director, of course, but he was in one movie called The Widow of St. Pierre. Mm-hmm. You've seen that, I'm sure, yeah? And I just asked him to please. He seemed perfect for the role for this rather strange security guitar playing man, you know? And so it's. It was, and I had the Polish twins were two directors themselves,
right.
You know. Yeah, so
right.
So it was like subjecting these directors to what they subject others to. It was a bit of fun. That was.
One of the themes that you really brought to this script was the art, the theme about the paintings and the art and the idea of originals and copies, which is in a sense what you're doing by.
Kind of.
Could you talk about how you developed that theme?
I felt a bit bad about making a remake. You know, I felt a bit shabby, and you know, I felt a bit. What would I say? I felt a bit like a faker. You know, and then I gave Bob this Picasso and decided to make that a fake Picasso, and came up with the ideas of the paintings, the real and the fake paintings. So in a way that I was just, I suppose, playing, it was an internal dialogue in a way, you know, playing with the idea of, you know, is there any virtue in a fake at all, really, you know?
Something that it might be, I don't know how easy it is for you to talk about, but the thing that to me is so strong in your films is the mood that they create. You sustain a kind of lyrical, romantic mood through, and it's expressed through camera work, through music. It's a quality that your films have that's very, very strong. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how you sustain that when, you know, how you create that on the set, how that happens.
It's, one is not aware of what one does, really. You know, mm-hmm. you do things because you are what you are, I suppose.
I mean, this feels like a Neil Jordan film in every.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Frame.
Is that a compliment?
Well, I meant it as a compliment. I guess somebody could mean it.
It could mean it the opposite.
The other way.
Couldn't it the other way? No, it's. I mean, this thing had to be all texture, really. You know, it had to be all light and shade, and it had to have a rotten kind of underground kind of scummy texture to the whole thing. You know, and. I don't know, really. That's just the way it. One starts by looking to the camera, you know, really, or you don't start. You start actually by trying to conceive what the image should be. And this, myself and Chris Menges, the cinematographer, we looked at a lot of Hong Kong movies, you know, these Wong Kar Wai and all these wonderful movies that are shot in these cities that are entire kind of cathedrals of light and neon, you know. I envy people who shoot over there because they never have to place a light anywhere, it seems to me. Because it's you know, they walk down these shopping malls and all, and they're fully lit, you know.
Yeah.
And but Nice is not as full of light as that. So we had to kind of build all sorts of practicals into every environment we were in, you know. And it gradually led to the contrast between the practicals gradually led to kind of a certain kind of image, you know. And then when we came to the casino, the casino really is constructed of lights in a way. The set is made out of these huge table lamps, you know, and they had a different quality to them. They had a different warmth and a more richer texture, you know, than the street kind of neon feelings that we'd worked with earlier. So that's how one builds it up, really.
And also in terms of mood, could you talk about your work with Nick Nolte? Because a lot of the texture of the film comes through how he delivers his lines and how the language sounds coming out of his... Man.
Yeah, if you can hear it. That was
right.
could you hear it? You could hear it, yeah? Because we had an enormous amount of... It was dicey. Well, I mean, your face, as a director, you're faced with a problem. You see the actor give this wonderful performance with this sense of secrecy, you know? And this low, mumbled thing. And you say, do I get him to articulate every line, you know, and to, so you can hear every word, because then the performance would be different, you know. And there was one scene in particular which we had to ADR entirely, the scene in the church. And I remember saying to Nick, if you knew we would have to go through this entire scene, it took us about 3 days, and you knew how much work we were going to have to put to even get people to hear what you're saying, would you have still played it that way? And he said, yeah, he would, because an actor has to find a way to play the scene, you know? Mm-hmm. And that secretive thing was his way. But, I mean, Nick just entered into the part, really. He built up his own history for it, and he kind of knew that recovery business more better than I did, you know? Because I haven't recovered yet.
Okay, let's open it. Let's see if anybody has any questions or comments. The question was about the motivation of Bob going into the casino, that in the original he knows he's going to get caught, and there's a change in your approach.
See, I was confused by I didn't know why they arrested him at the end in the original. I mean, he'd done nothing. He committed no crime. You know, everybody else was around outside, and they were all being shot and stuff like that, weren't they? I mean, he knew that he'd been betrayed in the original, but I wasn't aware that he knew the entire game was finished, you know? And there's a voiceover, there's Melville's voiceover, doesn't he, where he says, Lady Luck made him forget why he was there. Because Bob was in the casino meant to open some door or something, wasn't he? And he forgot to do it, you see? So I don't think he, in the original, he knew the game was up and he went in there.
Okay, were you inspired by Nan Golden's work, the photographer Nan Golden, in terms of the visuals?
No, I wasn't, no.
Okay. a New York photographer, I guess.
No, I wasn't. I'm sorry, I don't...
Okay.
I will look at her work, though. Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Well, one thing about that, I mean, just to follow up on that, but there's a feeling of spontaneity that the film has, and I know sometimes you see a movie that looks like it's very spontaneous, and maybe it wasn't in the making of it, but...
There was... I mean, that kind of spontaneity is really worked at, you know what I mean? What you were photographing, obviously, is spontaneous events, you know what I mean? But some of those shots were deep, were really complicated, and the end result feels like, you know, it feels almost like camera verite, but the elements involved are so complicated that it actually is not achieved through those means. You know, it's kind of heavily designed in a way.
Why did you decide to put give the Polish brothers an accent? Why do the American actors, the Polish or directors, the Polish brothers speak with an Irish accent?
Okay. When I looked at their performance, you know, and when I looked at them, they looked like these like really skinny, underfed guys from Tala in Dublin that I kind of knew, and I wanted them to be like that, so that's why I went that way.
Okay, did you think about doing more looping to make all the lines? Because the lines are so beautifully written, but not everyone is...
Well, I'll tell you, we went to enormous lengths to try and get people to hear this film, you know? I think it's also because there's so much dialogue, you know? You're probably not used to hearing films with all that dialogue, you know? And not all of it is well written. No, but I mean, sorry. The bits you didn't hear were really dumb lines, you know? I hope.
Did you ever think of using voiceover? Because that's such a tempting thing, I guess, from the...
I didn't know who the voiceover would be, you know, really. I didn't actually know. I didn't.
Okay, the motivation behind some of the freeze frames that scenes end with.
We shot a lot of sequences, you know, at 12 frames and 90-degree shutter, and we double-printed them to 24. You know, double-printed them so they'd run at 24 in the end. So, and you get this... staggered effect, yeah. And as Tony Lawson, the editor, was cutting the movie, he began to experiment with those freeze frames because it related to that kind of image, and they became a grammar that they became a thing we were using. They were ways to express to just, you know, kind of moments where the character would go from one point to another, or the story would take an unwarranted kind of leap. And it became a language we were playing with, you know. Not everybody likes them, I know, but...
How did you decide which scenes you would film that way, that you would film 12 in the 12 frame?
Generally scenes with kind of lateral movement, you know, with violent movement in it. It's the kind of thing Steven Spielberg did at the beginning sequence in Saving Private Ryan, you know. But there's a lot of that kind of movement. It gives you this almost newsreel effect, you know. So that's what those freeze frames came out of.
Okay, Annette? the Leonard Cohen song, was that a new song, or did you find that?
No, that was, he brought out a great album last year called 10 New Songs. That's what it was called, and it's from that. And I was looking for, I also tried a lot of Tom Waits, and the Tom Waits was too much like Nick Nolte, you know?
Right.
And he kind of dragged the whole thing into a fog of, you know, something or other. And Leonard Cohen, but both their voices suited the character, you know, and Leonard Cohen's voice was just, it just seemed to come out, it had the same depth and the same kind of, you know, the same tenor as Nick's voice. So I could have used a few more of his songs, but it would have been too much.
Okay, right here.
No, not at all. No. I've never used, done this before. I was just going for a very jagged photographic style, really, you know. Really to the feeling when you wake up and you're in desperate need of something to set you right, you know, really. That's what I was going with.
Okay, if you could talk a little bit more about the character of Vladimir, the computer operator, guitar player, and you know, if that was, how much that was like built on the, I guess, the real Kutsterica.
Well, no. I saw a concert with that band called Radiohead, and they had this laser device where the laser was bouncing around. It was obviously responding to what was being played by the different instruments. So I went to the guy who invented that laser device. He's one of these tech nuts, a delightful man from Sheffield in England or something like that. And I wrote it into the script that this was a device that this character Vladimir was working on while he was trying to work out how to undo the security system he'd built, you know. So he was that kind of character, really. And normally those characters in movies are nerdy guys with big glasses, aren't they, and stuff like that. And they're kind of thin and skinny. And I just, when I met Amir, I said, let's make him this big, vital, you know, cigar-chomping kind of guy. And Amir does play the guitar. You know, I didn't know he played the guitar when I met him. But, I mean, my character had to. He was, you know, copying these Jimi Hendrix riffs and stuff like that. And so that was the character, so that's what he did.
Okay, so if you could talk about your collaboration with Chris Menges and how you work with him to get the feeling that you want, you know, your style and your visual ideas.
This is more glamorous than most things he does, isn't it? Yeah. It's kind of richer in a way, and it's in some ways more structured. I've made three films with Chris now, or four I think it is, and he's one of the best cameramen there are. He tends to be very inarticulate, you know? Well, it's true, actually. I don't mean this as not a compliment, you know what I mean? But he strives to create a specific image that will relate to the specific film, you know? And it's, he goes to extraordinary lengths to do that, you know? And it's, and for this film, he kind of rethought his photographic history in a way for this film, you know what I mean? Because we decided to take a different approach, you know? And we decided to, just throw the book away slightly, you know, in terms of his aesthetic in a way, you know?
Okay, is there a change in Irish culture recently because of the opening up, I guess, of the country that relates to an opening up in visual style?
Traditionally, Irish culture has been made with that which is cheapest, you know, which needs, I mean, you don't need money to use language, you know what I mean? You don't have to pay to learn to play a jig and a reel on the fiddle, you know what I mean? And I mean, traditionally Irish culture has been built around words. There's any significant architecture there has come from England, you know, the architectural styles, and they're quite beautiful actually. But it's lately the obviously filmmaking is making its mark on the culture, and you know, the visual arts are becoming much more important. It's probably a function of the place becoming a modern place, you know, and I don't know what to say about that, but it is true what you say. Yeah, it's, and the literary culture is still there, but it's no longer the predominant thing.
Yeah. Okay, and I want to ask you as a sort of last question. You've said that for you, and also I guess for Nick Nolte, this was a way to make a European film, a film outside of the American system or the Hollywood system.
It's just I suppose this could have so easily been set in America. Do you understand what I mean? That you know, I just took a decision to make it in Europe, and it's I'm not sure how much whether this film would be welcomed in France, you know, because they probably see it as a very American film, you know. And they probably will, actually. We got this division, don't we, where American films are muscular and huge and massive, and European films have almost to their cost become define themselves as, you know, as art films in a way, you know. And I thought this is just a muscular, you know, straightforward story. You know, it hasn't got any pretensions to be an art movie or anything like that. And I thought I'd set it in Europe, an American kind of film in Europe. Do you understand what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. Okay, well, I want to wish you luck with it, and thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.